Hello and welcome to recording number 20 of Gary Gygax's Artifact of Evil, an annotated reading. Today is August 16th, 2021. We're right in the middle of an Uz chapter. This one has actually been full of interesting little tidbits as it describes his various servants and things. We just saw Uz sending out some of his greater and lesser sixes. Now, he has three of these groups, and they all seem to be a mix of very, very powerful kind of character types. Illusionists, magicians, clerics, thieves, assassins, fighters. And so what he's doing here is he is now sending out these groups in like small groups of like, say, one of the greater and one of the lesser, and going out, and he's got a general that he's mentioned out in the field. So and he's planning on attacking the hierarchs right now when they've suffered a loss, and that may be the banishment of Neryl. And that's from the previous chapter. Very important bits there. Now, he has just described and named a few of the different characters in his Greater Six. Kerman Mindbender, a Bakluni illusionist, is an important one. Now, I'm going to restart. It's page 190 and the second paragraph. Holga, my grand priestess, and Vane, too. For your magic, you two shall remain here for staff duty. Radaj Beasting, a fine pair to venture into the upper reaches of the Vesvi. There you will whip the sniveling Kelbits and Jeblai into a frenzy of hate against men and elves. Make the forest in the northern portion of the Valley of High Folk a carnal house. You will have assistance. Break. Well, they're going to need it. Now, Kelbits and Jebli, kobolds and goblins, perhaps. These are the Flan names that he's using. And as I was mentioning yesterday, Uz's mother is Yggdrasil, the mother of witches and a very powerful evil witch. Now, today, they're calling Tasha as a form of Yggdrasil. You know, who knows, that might work. But that's definitely something to decide for your own setting. It's not what I do with her. But anyway, it seems like she's old enough, she could be Flan, and therefore Uz would be, as a half-human, would be Flan himself. So, he is speaking the Flanish names for all these different monstrous creatures. All right, I'm going to restart. The only thing to say, right?
I found a site that says that Kelbits and Jebli are orcs.
I don't think so. Okay. I think Jebli are goblins, because hobgoblins are something like Ho Jebli or Ha Jebli. And I'm pretty sure Jebli means goblins, and Kelbits, I think, mean kobolds.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure of that. But not 100%, because I don't really use the Flanish names myself. Not unless I'm writing a story and I want to throw it in, but it's definitely supposed to be not the common tongue. And now the only thing here that I think is, it's interesting in a way that there must be in the Vesvi a large population of both Kelbits and Jebli, if Uz thinks that he can use them with the assistance of whoever Radaj Beasting is and some other allies as a way to go against the Valley of the High Folk. So it's interesting right there, but the part that it really is lore. Isn't that the storyline? It is the fact that Gygax is saying there are Kelbits and Jebli in the Vesvi. So that's the little bit that I extract as something more than story. Jebli, goblin, kobold, Iger, Jebline High, Jebline Hobgoblin, Uroz Orc, Kelisnil, yes, Demi-Humans, Hobnis for Halfling, Nanis for Gnome, Dwar-Alv, Durgar for Grey Dwarf, Svirfneplin for Deep Gnome, Drow for Dark Elf. Yeah, I'd see that one. That's more what I know. Are these various names? They're more than just Orc. Is just Uroz in Flanish, but we don't get much of the language. We're just getting right. A few little drops and bits and pieces that has been detailed in previous work. And Gygax wasn't any kind of Tolkien linguist or anything, so we're not getting, you know, some involved languages here. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page 190 and the third paragraph. As you command, Eldritch Lord, the two intoned in reply, then departed. Ormaz, Archmage, with Patch, my High Priest, you will go to the southern portion of the Vesvi, and likewise incite the bands there to murder and pillage. You will have companies of my woodsrunners and Eiger guards. This is a most crucial part of my plan, so you two will remain until all others have gone. Then I will give you final instructions. The huge bronze doors to the throne room were suddenly opened by the miserable slave demons, the Dretch, to allow the grand entrance of Eclavdra. In addition to her entourage of dark elves, the drow noblewoman was flanked by a pair of succubi and a cadaverous cleric arrayed in the full panoply of a priest of Grazd. Eclavdra strode into the chamber, bowed slightly and allowed a tiny smile to cross her lips as she addressed us. My lord has requested my attendance. Buzz was torn between laughter and fury. His demon sire had learned of Eclavdra's humiliation at the Cambion's hands and had sent her guards. A strikingly lovely and totally evil drow had accepted these reinforcements as a confirmation of her own status, and again she was speaking to us as an equal. What had Grazd promised her? Certainly queenship of all the dark elven folk. Who could guess what else? Well, no matter. Break. All right, so we're seeing Eclavdra again, and she is such a familiar figure from the, you know, the end of the Giant series in D3, and then through the D series, the Descent into the Depths of the Earth, or the Drow series, however you might call it. And she's such a familiar name and such a historical character. Now, Gygax is using her here, and she is at a kind of height of her power right here, where she's getting additions to her own abilities through Grazd, and so she's something more than a normal drow now. Now, the thing to look for here is that it's adding, in a sense, that this little bit is adding some lore, because with Eclavdra and us, it's a combination of storyline, but also some definite things about her entourage, her status. Even if you're not using Gygax's story, you can take some of the story and use it to, like, it describes her character and what she's like. Now, again, and this is a point that I really want to go over, is that Gygax tends to make all the evil characters cower and beg for their life if they're presented with something overpowering. So when Eclavdra first meets us, she's treating them as if they're equals, and he humiliates her, and she begs for her life. And it goes on and on with all these evil characters. Gleed begs for his life. The monk back with the Scarlet Brotherhood betrays his people and begs for his life. And I just think that, yes, I would think that the evil characters are maybe more selfish and think only for themselves, but it has become like this steady that any of the powerful evil characters, or even the lesser powerful ones, that they will they have no like backbone. They have no inner strength. And I found that very unlikely for the monk of the Scarlet Brotherhood, who you know is supposed to be following this set path. And you know, I just wish that some of the characters would be a little stronger and not like stamped into a certain mold. Oh, it's an evil character. You know, if we capture them, then we can get them to betray their own kind. So,
like that monk could have taken a suicide pill or something like that,
or fought to the death. And right. I mean, it would work with some of the characters, but it's just been every single evil character strong. You know, like the bandits were weak. Glee was a very powerful character. And even Uz himself, you can see where he really is afraid of Grast. And he's, previous to this, he was afraid of Narl, and the hierarchs of the Horn Society wasn't strong enough. So instead of, he's pretending, and I'm sure they know, but he's pretending to get along with them and strike when the time is right. Now that doesn't, it might be a wise course, but it doesn't speak of strength. It's, you know, it's just, and Uz in particular acts like a little child, you know, an evil little child. But, and there's a certain, you know, in Saga of Old City, one of the things we kept seeing was deception and discernment and disguise. You know, it was a part, a theme that recurred over and over. Now, we see a little bit of that in this book, but nowhere near as much. And one of the themes seems to be that evil characters, you know, they are not, they only act strong when they have that strength, when they have overwhelming power. Pardon me a sec. But, you know, it's as a theme for the storyline and as a characterization of all these different ones, these different rulers and even lesser down to the bandits who, you know, it just that if you're evil, you're not going to have a backbone. That, you know, if you're presented with, I just don't like that to be every single evil character we encounter.
Yeah, evil characters weren't like that in Saga of Old City.
No, and I don't know what, I just wonder how much of this book was, it's come out in 87, Gygax was gone from TSR, and I wonder how much of this book was Gygax, and how much of it was a manuscript that they owned and got it ready for publication. Because the first Saga of the Old City, I think, is definitely 100% Gygax, for good or ill. And this one, I don't know. There's all these little things here that tell me maybe this was a manuscript incomplete, finished by someone else, because there's so many little things. Like when Gord banishes Narl with the scroll at the last minute, that was yesterday, recording number 19, and that really set me off for the book, because, you know, it's just like, I was expecting, and Gygax would have written a good fight, and there might have been casualties, and there might have been, but there would have been interesting spells, and an interesting fight, and an example of very high-level play. Now, I just don't see how Narl was there, or Narl runs the Hierarchs. I just, you know, that to me was a big surprise, and I don't see how they could fight him, you know, even an avatar of him. And Gygax wasn't talking avatars right there. So there's just been a number of things that seem extremely, you know, off. And I'm not quite sure why. And some confusing bits and pieces with when we get to more complicated descriptions of travel and distances, there seem to be some more confusion in what's going on. You know, and I'm not sure if that is Gygax, or perhaps there was an editor that or a different writer that finished the book up.
Certainly could be.
Yeah. All right. All right. I am going to restart. We are on page 190 and the final paragraph. Requested. Well, I will let that pass, for there is much cause for magnanimity, said Uz with a mocking tone. My plans go ahead as expected. The Herricks are in confusion. The fraternity of devils curs is best with difficulties, beset with difficulties. I send forth my host on all fronts, and it comes near. A brief look of confusion passed over the features of the beautiful drow. All fronts, Lord Uz, Eclavdra asked. Just so. I, Magus Mole, will need the assistance of your best company of fighters, dear Eclavdra, during his foray into the lands to the southeast. Uz paused and gave the drow noblewoman a meaningful glance. Then he added, you and the remainder of your force here should most certainly accompany the expedition I'm sending into the Vesvay to bring retribution to the lowly elves and their ilk who dare to resist my will there. Olag, a diversion lady, though indeed I would have my city back. And who goes into the lands of the Herarchs, the dark elf, high priestess of evil, inquired slowly. Uz seemed slightly confused by and surprised by the question. No fear as to that. Fully half of my chosen ones will bring woe to those faceless wearers of cuckoldry, four of the best to confront the Herarchs directly, and a pair to raise allies amongst the Free Lords of the East. Like, the Free Lords of the East are the Bandit Kingdoms, what they call themselves, or what Gygax has been calling them since Saga of Old City. You know, Eclavdra is seeing something here, and maybe that, again, like with Theobald, who overestimated his power and what would happen to him, perhaps Uz here is overestimating his attack in the Vesvi, because Eclavdra just seems a little, like, thrown back by what is going on. It's not maybe the attack on the elves, though. It's definitely the attack on the Herarchs, who are at this point, a very powerful force. All right.
I think she doesn't really believe what he's saying. I mean, he's obviously lying about something, because that's what he does.
Yes, and he's also grandiose. You know, it's like he doesn't just... He makes all these statements how... He's going to take over the earth. He's, you know, he's so powerful. Remember, he is calling Tharizdun dung lump. You know, I mean, it is, you know, he was really testing things. He's being very insulting to his father, Grast, who's incredibly powerful. He's really, even Zuckmoy and Yggdrasil, who are the ones who helped him carve this bit of land out of the Flaness. He is very dismissive of both of them. Now, if he does get his hands on that second Theopart, then yeah, you know, it might be. Because the Theoparts in themselves are, without being combined, they are very, very powerful items. And in the past, it seems like the Sul must have had all three parts, because unless that lost city was not the lost city of the Sul, and it may not have been, but where the second Theopart was hidden was supposed to be a Sul city. Scarlet Brotherhood already has one of the Theoparts, which now the Scarlet Brotherhood in Gygax's Greyhawk, they are not a massively powerful group. They, that castle they had in Strandkeep Castle at the beginning of the book, that had to be one of the most open and powerful places that the Scarlet Brotherhood held, you know, in the outside world. Otherwise, they're a secret organization, and their homeland is held away, you know, from everybody else, and they are not a naval power. they might take their ships out on expeditions. They might try to take over islands or areas in Hepmana land where the native strength isn't that great. But they are not going to war against nations. At most, what they do is they try to be in the throne room, in the court of somebody, or they like to be an advisor. They like to be behind things. And why such a small group may have such power might be that first Theo part. You know, once they mentioned that the Scarlet Brotherhood had one already, then it kind of explains why they can be such a threat without being a large enough group really to be such a threat. And who knows what the powers of are supposed to be for that Theopart. They're not just general powers like being able to shoot a big beam and burn people down. They have various magical abilities, and each separate one is supposed to do something different. So I don't know what the first one does, but it may be something that helps with their influence over other people and their intrigue, because that's always the Scarlet Brotherhood is like a secret knife in the dark. It's not meant to be out in the open with lines of troops. And if you look at Strandkeep Castle, a part of their great strength were the ogres, the gnolls, and the trolls. That was their great fighting force, not ranks of scarlet-clad humans. So, I just don't think us, without that second Theopart, is anywhere near as powerful. And when we found out that Nerol, you know, himself, was in control of the Horn Society, that Nerol is a greater god. He should be much more powerful than us, but he shouldn't be on Earth, so I don't know what's up there. All right. I am going to restart. It is page 191, and the fourth paragraph, from the end. "So," murmured the drow noblewoman, "that explains the great disturbance to the south. At the very gate into the realm of the Hierarchs, I am told." "What?" the Cambion demanded. "What's that you say?" Clavra went on blithely, and the Reaper himself was thought to have had something to do with the flux and disruption of forces arcane. She trailed off, pondering hardly, glancing at the stony-faced demi-demon sitting enthroned before her. Suddenly, Aklavdra's beautiful face worked with fury. "You fool!" She bit the word off when she saw the burning and sickly fire within Uz's eyes, contained her anger, and smoothed her countenance in her words. "Fortunately, seek to take advantage of the Hierarch's weakness now, of course. So instead of going westward into the depths of Vesvi Timber, I will send all of my minions, your servants, Lord Uz, eastward, with the army attacking Molag." Snarling, Uz spat, "I command otherwise. Yes, Lord of Evil, but I am only a mere ambassador. I must do as my master Grazd commands. Even before I obey you, it is your father's wish that the drow force be sent to the area of greatest threat, shall we say." Uz shot from his throne, his visage a mask of terrible rage. The drow noblewoman took an involuntary step backward, closer to her attendants. This made the Cambion pause and glare at them. Corpse-like cleric and demoness alike fingered the basalt symbols of Grazd that they wore around their necks, but all stood resolute. The ire slowly drained from Uz, and he spoke again. "As you point out, my father Grazd wishes otherwise, and he, like me, is a sovereign in his own realm. Because he is all these things and more, I choose to grant your request to send your force against our enemies squatting in Molag. Now be gone. I've had enough of Drow and their servants for today. Alright, break. The mention of demonesses is probably the two succubi that are attendant to Eclavdra. Now, here we have again, now, Eclavdra definitely sees something and sees the foolishness of Uz's choice to attack the Vesvi instead of going for the Hierarchs right now when they're disrupted and attacking their capital of Molag. I kind of think both of them should be, you know, more... the Vesvi might be a surprise for us with the power of the resistance of the High Folk. But, you know, who are the elves and the other people living in the Valley of the High Folk. And then attacking the capital of the Hierarchs, I don't know. I mean, it just seemed like they were a vastly powerful group, but who knows what's happened to Nerol. But again, one of the important things is we see with Drow's, Uz's character, that Eclavdra bites her words off to not, because she knows she can drive Uz too far. Even if he is respectful and fearing of his father, Eclavdra is not his father, and if he gets too mad, he would kill her, or terrible things. Now, so we see that Eclavdra, in the face of Uz's strength and wildness, will back down. But she's a little smarter than Uz here. And Uz will back down because, again, he is, he's acknowledging things about Grazd that are very difficult for him to say. He's really... now, Grazd would sneer at him, but right now he's really kind of showing that Grazd is his equal at the very least. And of course more, but you know, it is just this characteristic of all these evil creatures. Now, one of the other things I thought was interesting was about the makeup of his greater six and lesser six here. Where was the comment? I'm sorry, in all this, I've passed that comment. I'm not sure. All right. It's just about his faithful servants here. All right, I'm going to restart. And it is page 192. And the fifth paragraph down from the top. The chamber was absolutely silent as Eclavdra and her train departed. As the bronze doors boomed shut behind them, Uz surveyed his minions without expression. Each betrayed an emotion, outrage, shock, anger, unbelief. Ah, the Cambion thought to himself with pleasure. All save Hauga suspect nothing. Uz waved a huge taloned hand toward his servants and addressed them. Come close and gain wisdom. As they advanced toward him, he continued, Am I not Uz, lord of ancient and eldritch evil? Could you serve a lesser being? Why then do you doubt me now? But we must take precautions, for this palace is as rife with traitors and spies as the Vesvi. None do I trust save you. And you but little. Now cast your wards and meshes to prevent all from learning what you are about to have revealed. There was a flurry of activity as the greater and lesser members of Uz's chosen did as commanded. All is secure, Lord, said Hauga after a time. Uz nodded and spoke in a conspiratorial tone. I am much pleased with my faithful servants, you especially, and one who is coming to join you. All my enemies have proved themselves to be fools and dupes. Mark you all, the lickspittle slaves of the self-righteous do-gooders brawl with the lock-stepping prancers after devil's dung. Their champions chase after decoys. Hierarchs invoke their vaunted master, and that one plays the prince of fools. At this revelation, Hauga dared to ask, Lord of Pain, will you enlighten us further? Buzz was feeling magnanimous. Yes, my little ones, I shall. Ormoz, you are a good left hand to me, and Patch the thumb of it. You must reach most carefully into the Vesvi, and withdraw a dwarf in what he bears. You mean, said the cleric, Patch in awe. Yes, Lear does, horribly. And wise you were not to speak of it. Dwarf is called Obmi, an old and well-used servant of mine. Cherish him. If a choice must be made, bring what he bears and leave him to his own recourse. Ormuz and Patch, in this you cannot fail. The pair bowed in acknowledgment of their charge. Splendid. Now, Halga, you are my right hand, and vain its thumb, as it were. I must coordinate a great effort now. You are the ones who will assist me in this first step toward rulership of Earth, and more, too, when the time is ripe. None must be certain of my plans and motives. Will I send my forces to Vesvi and the elven realm of the High Folk? We know that will be, but it is a sideshow. Olag and the Herricks, of course, as dear as my desire to bring those sheep to skewering, it too is a distraction. The bandit kingdoms, again, certainly, they're but petty allies, good for any time I choose. But let the Shieldlands and Furiundi think otherwise. Eclavdra and her drow, she will aid in the subterfuge, all the better unknowing. Better still, she will help to hoodwink the one who proudly names me son. Drow companies will bedevil the marches to the far west, and Valuna will turn that way in fear and consternation, torn between the hordes of the Scarlet Brotherhood in the Kron Hills, and the threat of what might transpire in Bissell. Long is my memory, all-pervading my tentacles of action. And there is yet more. My dearest mother has duped those red wrap bundles of filth. Her war is only a distraction for her. I am well informed that she has come upon the prison of Queen Zuchtmoy, and in a short time, my lady of Fungi will join us here in Duraka with Yggdrasil. She shall share my coming triumph. Buzz paused to allow admiring looks and murmured praise to wash over his obscene bulk. Our Lord of Evil is all victorious, offered one underling. We acknowledge the ever-burning evil which now lights the Empire of Uz, said another. It went on like this for some minutes. Then the Cambion made a small gesture, and there was silence again. And now, my vassals, the best of all, Uz said softly with a leering smile. The Hierarchs so misread what I was doing that their number brought the turd head of death, their miserable master, to foil me. A reaper reaped not, but something unsatisfactory, for he and the Hierarchs who bust his bony bum at every step are gone, vanished from the skin of earth. With them went an army of the Hierarchs' finest soldiers and bestial servants, a host of great strength. Where? Well, might you wonder. They're all slain, these lesser ones. They fertilize the good weeds and feed the distended bellies of the scavengers for 100 miles. There is no power of good, not one, nor any being of any menace to us there, Uz said reassuringly, as he saw the concerned expressions on the faces of his loyal henchmen. Of that I am most certain, so let your minds be at rest. He said this without allowing any hint of his lack of other knowledge to color his reassurance. Uz was annoyed at being unable to determine exactly what had happened, but the opportunity was there nonetheless, and he had seized it with an iron grip. The Horn Society is sorely wounded, and we shall deliver the Coup de Grace to them as a bystroke of our grander scheme. No interference from Hades will be forthcoming. Four departed thereafter, and Uz sat in his chair, envisioning his empire to come. A break. This is the end of chapter 17, page 194. So You know, that was quite a bit of exposition there without breaking. We get some lore in the actions that are happening. And you can see that one of the later box sets was called Greyhawk Wars. And they did this massive war. They destroyed the Horned Society. And, and many other things were jumbled and thrown around. But I don't think, as we read this, I'm not sure if the original intention was to have exactly this massive war. I always get the feeling that Uz is way out of, out of his bounds here, that his ambitions far, far exceed his abilities. So until he gets, until he gets that second part of the tripart evil relic, until he gets that second key, I don't think he's going to be able to defeat these various foes that he's going out all at once. You know, he's splitting his forces up. He's attacking the Vesvi, but partially the attack is a distraction because what he wants is, he told Abmi, go to the Vesvi and you'll be met by a force and taken back to Daraka in honor. And then, so we have all this turmoil going on. But we really don't know. I don't know if Furiondi is going to react, because really this invasion was no real invasion. They crossed the Vang River, the Hierarchs did. They attacked Melf. They didn't really attack anything in Furiondi. And that army that he brought with him is now dead. If Uz is correct, it's the bones of those thousands of different things. I believe there were supposed to be thousands of hobgoblins, that they're all strewn across the fields there. So I think it's, at this moment, yes, they have the Hierarchs weakened, but I don't envision this great war. Now, that was these manuscripts, and I think that Sea of Death and Knight Errant, the short stories, were all written before Gygax was thrown out of TSR and formed his own company. And the last books in the series, there's three books after Knight Errant, and those were just Gygax writings after. And I just get the feeling with those books, I don't like to jump ahead so much, but I just get the feeling that his ideas changed and there was a lot of, unfriendly feelings about what had happened to him, and they expressed themselves in the writing. So I kind of take what happened in those books with a grain of salt, because at the very end, everything's destroyed. But I think that the people who were designing the campaign for second edition, I think that they definitely read these books. I mean, they were TSR manuscripts. There's no reason they wouldn't have. But I think they're definitely influenced by all this stuff that Gygax wrote. Mainly because there's really nothing else before that. Before Gygax wrote these books, there was no detail from TSR on anything. You had the folio, you had the box set, bare bones, very undetailed. And I don't think until Gygax came out with these things, you weren't getting all these little bits and pieces. You weren't having the life breathed into the campaign. And I think what's very successful about these books is that Gygax managed to encapsulate, I think, what the popular version of the Greyhawk campaign was about. But then, of course, as time goes on, it gets to be higher level and higher level. I wanted to jump back, because I mentioned Knight Errant. Back in recording, maybe 17 or 18, no, maybe even 19, Gygax finds this scroll in his whole pouch of holding, and it miraculously is a banishment spell powerful enough to dispel Narl and these demons and wipe out this huge host. And I didn't like it very much, that little MacGuffin popping up, but he got it from this raid on a vampire in the city of Greyhawk called Plincourt. And I had wondered, what the story is there. So when I checked my references, the next and only other mentions of Plincor are in Knight Errant. So Knight Errant is composed of different stories, mostly about the city of Greyhawk. So obviously this story, there is a story about Plincourt the vampire, which I find very interesting, and I'm almost tempted to read it now, but I'm saving Knight Errant for its order of appearance and publication. And so if you're interested in that little tidbit, you could look back in the book Knight Errant, and there is a short story, I don't know which one yet, because just looking at the references, about that vampire Plincor and probably Gord and Chert having some adventure there. All right. Like I said, this is, you know, monumental stuff going around here. So if you do not want to do these great wars, which is not a favorite thing with me, even to the point you don't want to do this war with the Scarlet Brotherhood fighting in the Whelkwood and in Kron Hills, and with us now attacking the Hierarchs, if you're not really prepared to shake up your campaign in this way, you can still use a lot of this information, if you want, to flesh out things about us and his powers and his armies, and also the Hierarchs of the Horn Society. And I had never, even though I've read these books many times, I had never really thought of putting Narrow as the head Hierarch. And from what Uz has said in this chapter, it seems like he can only exist here once he's summoned, because he mentions that the Hierarchs have summoned him. And so, you know, that adds to how the Hierarchs are set up and what powers they have. Now, right now, they've lost their connection to Hades, according to us. And I say this all the time, but you have to take everything anybody says in this book with a grain of salt, because they are all unreliable. All these things, Gygax loves writing from the point of view of characters, and from Geller, from Gord, from Chert, and those points of view are really not correct. If you go all the way back to the Folio, P. Smedger is in the future, Pluffett Smedger, and he has found all these books, history books, on the Greyhawk campaign, and it puts it into the story, the lore. And but he himself is an unreliable narrator. So what, besides being very fragmentary and bare bones, the Folio and the block box set, that information is always, again, taken with a grain of salt. And all this adds, it aids the do-it-yourself quality that Gygax liked, that he did himself, and that because of that, he really thought everybody was going to do it yourself. He really was did not think people would want modules or settings, because he just assumed you'd rather play in your own. So this Greyhawk setting was kind of, I think, a surprise to him that it was taken on so much. But it is. But it is definitely for us to do whatever we want with. So in this story, we're moving in a certain direction. That's the story. But we see examples of game mechanics, and that's worth looking at for role-playing or seeing how the first edition would work through Gygax's thoughts. And he's always adding things from updated material, like Unearthed Arcana, The Fiend Folio, Monster Manual 2. He's always taking things out of them and adding them to these stories, because, you know, he really showed the mechanics. But finally, there is what to me is the most important, is the lore. And with the lore, we can look at these things and see information that, even though it's connected with this moving storyline, it can be used without that war story as a background. So even though we hear about, like, Narrow being banished, we might like having Narrow and say, all right, well, I'm not going to use that, but I'm going to use the idea that the head of the Hierarchs is Narrow, and he can be summoned if the need is great, and they have these great spells and powers that have been described. and these things. So all the time when we get these descriptions of like armies and characters, that can add to the lore. But the lore is always different from the story. The story moves on, but the lore can be set in a certain year. Like, say this is 576, then we are fleshing out 576. Now, in 579, all this may be different. In 591, it's very different. That's where they took, you know, the third edition Greyhawk up to, I believe, 591. So all this time can be passing, but lore can be set in certain years. So when I read this book, even though things are on the move, that we learn about Greyhawk from when Gord was 12, and now we've got Gord about 28 or 30, we're still using that information to flesh out a single year, really, so that we can have a complete campaign and then start moving it forward or move it backwards in stories and play. But if one of the things that you like to do is find information that helps your campaign. And so even though this was a lot of exposition, and it does give us a lot of lore about the Horn Society and us, and if we want to use it, this is Gygax's vision, but if Gygax's vision is copacetic with your own, then definitely you grab it. All right, I'm going to restart. We are now on chapter 18. It is page 195, and I'm starting at the first paragraph, the first word here. Droll, as amusing as a kitten, affirmed the master cat. At that, Gord's companions burst into laughter. His expression was pained at the indignity of the analogy. At the sound of his friend's hilarity, the young adventurer assumed a haughty expression and turned away, ostensibly to admire the pair of massive spotted lions that purred beside the padded armchair in which the cat lord sat. Keller came to Gord's rescue, and it was not you who brought us here. Hardly, Bard. It is much a mystery to me as it is to you. Make the best of it, as I'm doing. You'll manage, their host drawled. This brought more, if somewhat uneasy, laughter from the others. Contemplating the course of events, I might hazard an opinion, the velvet-garbed fellow added. We would be grateful for your counsel, sir, Geller said in a way which indicated that master was not being asked to instruct pupil. As you wish, said the master cat, with a knowing smile. Lord simply botched the spell. He mispronounced the key sounds, as it were, reversing them. His inclusion of me, the incantation of my name, wrought the final stage of the Deomer. Instead of whisking Narl and his bestial steed off to Hades, young Gord here managed to bring you all with him here, to my secret domain. Most droll. You related that your comrade, Inkosi, had been made panicsome by the aura of these daemonkin. He was beyond the power of the spell. As to the other, Lizard, I believe you named him. Well, the dead are not subject to much such magic. Lord flushed in embarrassment. I meant to call certain powers to our aid. How could I manage to get it so wrong? Better you here than me there, their host said fervently. I have no desire to stand face to face with the Reaper, at least not with great preparation and strong allies. How you manage to bring all here is a conundrum, for this place is hid betwixt and between the ethereal, astral, and primaterial planes. There is that of the cat in you for certain, Gord. Do not, I pray, become apprentice to a spellbinder, though, else who knows what havoc you will wreck with the recondite arts. Right. All right. So we're seeing here in this chapter an answer and a major shift. And also something to consider about what we just heard from us. Now, according to the Master Cat, all right, the Master Cat is the Lord of Cats. He has his secret, there's a secret plane, like he said, just for them, that is between astral, ethereal, and prime material. So, you know, here we're getting some wonderful background information. Now, Gord, last named Rexphilus, the name of the master cat, and in that spell, which he botched, and so now the group has been transported to this plane. But according to Rexphilus, it has not taken Narrow. Now, I don't know what Uz is getting his information. Is he completely wrong? He mentioned that all the lessers were killed, and they may have been. But, you know, you don't know. So we have this right here where this is a really momentous part of the story. And, of course, you know, they're all taken safely away, and they're now on this this plane. So there's a lot, a lot here. Unfortunately, like they said, Lizard is dead, and Kosi had run. Patrick and Moon had been sent off. So we're really here with some of the main characters who I believe a lot of them were actually played characters in Gygax's game. I think Biff was, who's the halfling thief. And we know Melf, you know, was Luke Gygax's character. I'm not sure about Chert and Gord, whether they just were created for this, and Geller and Curly Greenleaf as well. All right, I'm going to continue right here. It is page 196, and it is paragraph 4. As the group relaxed in chuckling and banter, the Master Cat looked at them with a not unfriendly gaze. Bird humanoids with feline features and tails appeared. They served the adventurers fermented mare's milk, an assortment of snacks, slivers of fowl, bowels of ground raw meat, pickled fish, smoked shellfish. The adventurers ate the food and drank the kumis with obvious pleasure. Kumis is the fermented mare's milk. I'm not sure if it is an earthly term. I know that various horse nomads used to drink this. All right, and Chris has put up in the fiction text channel here the Cat Lord. Cat Lord or Master Cat, ruler of all forms of felines. Now, one of the things, he only has 81 hit points, but he's treated as a 19 hit dice creature. Now, he himself does not want to go against, would not go up against Narrow. Here's a little thing about kumis. Kumis is fermented dairy product made from mare's milk or donkey's milk. It is still drunk by the Central Asian steppe people of Turkic and Mongol origins and Kazakhs, who... Kazakhs are it's the old term for the Cossacks, they've changed a lot. They were originally a group of people who were from various cultures who banded together and were called the Cossacks at first. All right. So kumis is actually a earthly drink right here. All right, I'm going to restart. We're getting pretty near the end, but I'll put in a paragraph or two here. Page 196 and the fourth paragraph from the end. The Cat Lord arose, but insisted that they continue their meal. There are matters I must attend to, but I request that you remain and enjoy yourselves as my guests. Such stuff as bread, vegetables, and fruits will come later. It is provender of the sort unusual to this place. When you have had your fill, simply sound this silver bell here. My servants will come and see to your needs. Rooms are prepared for each of you, and there will be those things you require to be clean and comfortable as well. Enjoy yourselves until I return. And come, he said, and simply vanished as he stepped through a nearby doorway. Melf, pulled a long face at the style of the departure. That is no great trick. True master, said the halfling Biff. I've seen you do it, thanks to that. Enough, commanded the elven adventurer crossly. You will bore these good folks with your silly banter. Gordon Chert had embraced heartily, pounding each other on the back, and giving vent to cries of joy and welcome when they found themselves together in their initial place of entry, a park and garden surrounded by a circular building of stone and logs and other stuff that seemed to spring from the earth and blend into the greenery that in turn surrounded and sheltered it. They had fallen from a gray limbo, a gut-wrenching nothingness that made their teeth ache and their nerves tingle, into an idyllic verdure before the feet of a huge statue of a saber-toothed tiger, hewn from ochre-toned feldspar. As if in answer to Gord's wild thoughts of reassuring surroundings, the homely face of a gangling barbarian popped into view. The tangle of curly brown hair and the winsome grin could belong to only one individual in all the multiverse. "Kurt," exclaimed Gord, "what on earth?" All right, I'm afraid we're getting pretty late here. Maybe just a little more. Wait a minute. Then the salutations and introductions had begun, only to be rudely interrupted by the appearance of a half-score of snarly-visaged jaguars, as these felines were called, they later learned, that surrounded them and kept them on edge until the sudden appearance of their master, the Cat Lord. Gord, previously acquainted with his august personage, was immediately recognized by this worthy, and the master called off the huge cats. All right. Like Plincourt, I'm breaking here, it's page 197. Like the mention of Plincourt the vampire, I'm imagining that we might find in Knight Errant a story which explains this, because as far as I know, Gord has not encountered the Cat Lord, and he should not be aware of each other. I'm 100% sure that has not happened, except when we go to Knight Errant and then to City of Hawks, we are going to deal with the past. Knight Errant will be all over the place, but I think a lot of it deals with the time after, at the end of Saga of Old City, when Gordon Chert stayed in Greyhawk. And I think a lot of the stories there take place in there. But it's not published yet, so I won't jump ahead to those stories. All right.
I posted that because when Gord read the Scroll of Banishment, it says that thieves 10th level and higher have a 25% of misunderstanding them. That's what might have happened.
Exactly. I think that's exactly what happened. And I like to see Gygax using the rule system. People, complain about, you can hear the dice rolling. Well, you can't. What you're hearing is something to use at the table. Instead of you roll the dice, but then instead of it just being like a game of Risk where you're rolling dice, then the game starts being fleshed out more. It starts being, well, you have a description of what a banishment spell gone wrong is like. You have a description of Lightning Bolt and Everd's tentacles and all these different things. You get descriptions of how Gord uses his magic, how fights occur. There's so much description in these, and what you can use them for is enriching your own game. And so, like right here, that business with the banishment spell, sure, there is a description of part of it, but also how Gord struggled with it. And, all this is something that you need to, it enriches the game and the player experience for things not to go right all the time. Things to go wrong. And here Gygax is showing various ways that can happen and how to describe them. So you're not hearing the dice What you're hearing is the sounds that can overcome the dice of your own game, so that the player isn't thinking about dice rolls. They're thinking about what the dice rolls envision, what they're doing to the character. You know, I don't want to see how my blood is circulating through my body. I want my body to do various things. I don't want to have to think about how the muscles move and the joints move and the bones move. I'm just saying, do this. And it's much more exciting. And, all right, I broke here. There's you know, little stuff going on. I'm surprised. The last thing is that Chert was recognized by, I'm sure, that in the last passage we read, in the fight before the banishment cell, that Chert was recognized by Gord. So I'm a little surprised that he'd be surprised with Gord ending up by him. Maybe I'm wrong. I have to, again, go back and take a look. All right, 7 o'clock, so it is time, 7:01 actually, time for to kick Craig out of the room. And this was recording number 20 of Artifact of Evil. It just astounds me. I mean, we're very far. I would say we're only looking at maybe another, 15 or 20 more readings. That seems like a lot. But, you know, we're more than halfway through the book. Oh, wrong thing. All right. I'm going to say good night. Chris, was there anything else?
Good night.
Good night.